Hello, students, and welcome to Class of X, the free internet course on how to read and enjoy the X-Men comics better. I'm your teacher and host, John Reisinger, and today we're answering a question everyone is going to want to know the answer to this month of March of 2024. What the heck were the X-Men up to in 1997? That's right. Welcome back to the show, because today we are recognizing and frankly celebrating the upcoming release of X-Men 97, the Disney Plus cartoon series that I'm pretty sure we've all been waiting for since September of 1997, when the original Fox Kids show aired its final episode. September 20th, 1997 was a sad day. It was the last day we got to hear a new episode of that show with the very iconic opening title song. And we're going to be, you know, celebrating and looking back on that by looking at what the heck the X-Men were doing in the comics during 1997. Specifically, I challenged myself with going back and reading every Uncanny X-Men comic from 1997. Uncanny X-Men has always been the flagship title for the X-Men, but there's definitely other titles that were going out at the same time, and I do plan on reading those as well, but I figure we can cover 12 issues of a comic in one episode, and I think that would be smart. So we're going through Uncanny X-Men 342 to 352. I know you can do the math in your head, and you're like, John, that's only 11 issues. You're right. There was another issue called Uncanny X-Men. It was actually listed as Uncanny X-Men -1. That was a kind of a flashback issue that I'm not going to cover in this episode, but we are going to go over everything that's happening Uncanny X-Men in 1997. And this was a fun experiment, because while I am one of the biggest X-Men nerds, I imagine, that's out there in this modern day, I was not a rich little nerd who could buy comics constantly all the time and bought all the X-Men comics all throughout my youth. I had to kind of pick and choose, and I took some breaks sometimes at buying comics because I just didn't have the time or money to be able to read them. And I would wait till being able to like check books out from the library, you know, or buy trade paperbacks eventually. So in 1997, I wasn't actually reading all of these comics. This was during an era that I wasn't aware of everything that was going on. I was reading and picking and choosing. Like I said, there was Uncanny X-Men and X-Men and Generation X and Wolverine and all of these things going on. And so I wasn't buying everything. And so this was fun to go back to and read this stuff, because turns out this was like right before I started buying X-Men comics more regularly again, because I remember all of this leading to comics that I do own. But specifically this year of comics was kind of a refresher. There's a lot of information I already knew, but it was fun to read the source material for the first time in many cases, and get to, you know, read the origins of characters like Joseph and go back to when Gambit's secret was revealed and all these things that I know about and are iconic, but again, hadn't read all of the issues about. This was during the Scott Lobdell era of writing, and it was most of the illustration work for these issues during this year were by Joe Majuera. Scott Lobdell is maybe not the most, I don't want to be mean and say the most skilled, but his dialogue was sometimes left wanting in my head. However, the plot points and some of the moments are still iconic and so beautiful and dramatic, and in some instances heartbreaking. This is a really sad time for some of the characters like Rogue and Gambit, but it's that drama that we all crave and love that builds these characters and gives them, you know, beefy backstories and foundations that matter. And so I still do applaud Scott's work during this year, and I'm such a nerd for Joe Majuera's style. I've quoted it as being like kind of a mixture of anime and cell cartoons, like cell shading cartoons, and like, you know, old school comic style, but it's all very like, it's uber colorful, it's a lot of dramatic shadows, big dramatic poses, it's very dynamic, a lot of action stuff. This was like modern X-Men style, you know, design, where in their earlier years with like Chris Claremont and Louise Simonson. It's a lot of heavy dialogue and not a lot of dynamic designs to the panels and the comics as comparatively to how they became in the 90s. Because everything, if you remember, in the 90s was extreme. And so this was that era, and I love it. The covers are extreme and beautiful, and I had so much fun just kind of even just browsing these stuff. There's some great designs to the costumes. This is part of the era where this team of the X-Men that was like I guess led by Rogue at the time, they went to Shi'ar space, and so they got these really iconic Shi'ar outfits. These outfits became so recognizable that they became toys, and it's always fun when the X-Men get to get new costumes, and then they're fun. That's like part of the fun of things like, you know, Age of Apocalypse, where you get to see a redesign of these characters. People always love that. It's part of why like so many other properties do the same thing. You know, the Power Rangers get new costumes every 5 weeks, it feels like. You know, everyone's trying to give a new take on Batman's costume, which it seems to be difficult to do considering the subtlety of his style, but it's amazing to see everybody take a stab at. So yeah, I highly recommend, after listening to this wonderful podcast that informs you on how to understand these comics, I insist you go check out the comics. At the very least, Google some of these issue covers and you'll be like, oh, Joseph looks so cool. Oh, I love how Gambit and Rogue look in their Shi'ar outfits. Bishop is stylish as ever in these ones. To help you understand this stuff, because it's very confusing. I will note that this is an era that there is so much backstory and so much going on, and this is involving a lot of the non-classic characters and stories that a lot of people don't understand. I think it's a really good episode to do if anybody wants to go back and do the 90s stuff, because I'm going to give you a little bit of like backstory previously before 97. I'm going to tell you what's going on during 97, and I'm going to give you a little bit of what happens after 97. I'm not going to go through each issue and give you a play-by-play. I'm trying to move away from that format because I don't know if that's as interesting as just basically going through the bits of what's happening here and kind of introducing you to some of these characters and telling you like what's going on. Because you might read this and be like, I don't know who Joseph is. Why does this man who's just got a name like a single word name like Madonna, why does he look like Magneto, and why is he like amnesiac, and what's going on? And don't worry, I'm here. This is what this podcast is for. This is for you to be like, even if you're like, I kind of know who Joseph is, but I don't really know what his origins were or like what he did with the X-Men. And I'll be like, well, you know, he did a lot during 1997. But before we get to him, there is a overarching story that's going on in the X-Men at this point, because we are coming off of the Onslaught event, which is another episode I've said I wanted to do, but I'm scared to do the Onslaught episode because it is a huge event. It is a huge event, and I don't know how I'm going to be able to like summarize that in one episode. I know it's a lot of reading, so that's why I'm also like I have to like straddle reading stuff for this show, but then also I like to read my own stuff that I'm reading, you know, all the current stuff that's going on in Marvel, and I've got a lot of Boom Studios comics that I'm enjoying, and so it's a lot of reading, and Onslaught just feels daunting, but very exciting because I like Onslaught. Onslaught's very it feels like divisive as far as like a point in Marvel Comics history. I like it. That's just me, though. But I think you can tell I'm someone who it's easy for me to enjoy a lot of comics because I just like to enjoy them. I like to find the good in a lot of this stuff. It's very rarely I'm reading something and I'm like, I hate this and I want to put it down. Happens, but it's rare. But we're coming off of Onslaught, which was Professor Xavier going super crazy. And to defeat him, all the classic Marvel superheroes have been seemingly killed. They're not actually killed, but the world is just watched one of the biggest mutant villains ever just create a cataclysmic event, and also killed, you know, seemingly, you know, Fantastic Four and the Avengers and all that kind of stuff. So Xavier did a no-no, and all the heroes are gone. So everyone extra hates mutants. Not that they needed a reason to hate them more, but you know what? Let's keep giving them new ones just so they remember, oh yeah, they're different. I'm afraid of them. I will fear them. And so what that allowed Bastion to do, which we've talked about Bastion a few times now, Bastion is the evolved form of Nimrod. And Bastion, he's posing as like just a normal looking dude. He gets the U.S. government to enact the Operation Zero Tolerance. And Operation Zero Tolerance is exactly how it sounds. It's just basically the government finally sanctioning, yeah, y'all should round up the mutants. That's what we should finally do. Let's go ahead and do it. And so you've got people like Graydon Creed, who are like leaders of the mutant hating groups, and they're loving this. But what helped this go forth even more is that Graydon Creed, who was, you know, basically the leader of mutants KKK, but he was running as a presidential candidate. He gets assassinated by Mystique, who, if you don't remember or don't know, that's his mom, actually. That family's a little screwed up. But that also, you know, if not for, you know, Onslaught wasn't good enough reason, well, everyone just watched a mutant assassinate their presidential candidate. So Bastion gets approval for this and implements these sleeper agents that are these prime sentinels that are meant to round up as many of mutants as possible. And they, a lot of people, the majority of the prime sentinel people don't know that they are that. They are in fact, like what I said, sleeper agents, and they're activated at some point. Sometimes in order to defend something, like someone being attacked, or sometimes when they die, they activate upon that kind of a situation. So that's going on right now with the X-Men and the mutants. So that's like this cloud that's hanging over all of the X-Men, over all the titles. In fact, if you go to some of these issues, you'll see the title Operation Zero Tolerance over like the X-Men title on the comic cover, actually, just so you're aware that that's going on. Or it might be a bug on the bottom like part of the comic book cover. But yes, this is the Operation Zero Tolerance era. So not a good time for the X-Men, but it's also a confusing time because, like I said a second ago, they have met a new friend named Joseph. Joseph was, he had his mysterious first appearance happen in X-Men 46 in 1995. So just a little bit prior to 1997. And he just appears as this, what seems to be a younger Magneto, has the same powers as Magneto, looks like younger Magneto, but has amnesia and doesn't know what's going on. And I won't go into all the stuff that Joseph was doing prior to 1997, but he was like sprinkled throughout the Onslaught event because Magneto was supposed to be dead at this point. He makes his way to America eventually, and he even tries to be Magneto because everyone keeps telling him he's Magneto. And so he joins up with the Acolytes, who have been pining for Magneto for a while at this point. And he tries to do it, but he's like, I'm not bad enough to be Magneto. And he gives up for, you know, altruistic reasons, moral reasons, and eventually goes and joins the X-Men. And they take him in partly so they can keep an eye on him because they don't buy this at all. This seems like a simple plot for Magneto to try to infiltrate them or to absolve himself of his sins if he magically was able to euthan himself somehow. If you guys remember, we talked about in early issues that there was a point in Magneto's history where he was, by a creation of his own, turned into a baby, and he was taken care of by Moira McTaggart and then eventually found his way back to his prime age, which kind of happens during X-Men, like the 1990s X-Men with Jim Lee. And so this is not abnormal for Magneto to keep changing ages. He joins the X-Men and kind of fosters or gains a close relationship with Rogue, which Gambit is not a fan of for so many obvious reasons. For those of you who don't know and are being like, why would Joseph and Rogue be so funsies with each other? Rogue and Magneto have had this kind of like, you know, relational sexual tension since Uncanny X-Men 274, which is a while ago, since we're talking about Uncanny X-Men 342 to 352 right now. But this happened during this Savage Lands kind of thing in 1991, where they were trapped there. It's kind of like the whole like trope of like being trapped on a desert island and you kind of fall in love with whoever you're with and that kind of thing. And so people have differing opinions on whether or not Magneto and Rogue should have this kind of tension with them. Again, I'm of the party of the people who kind of like it. It's fun. It's a little soap opera-esque. It makes sense to me. I think mostly because I am attracted to Magneto, so and I love Rogue, and that's just me going like, yes, be a couple. You're very cute together. And then, not to mention, like during Age of Apocalypse, during that alternate reality story, Rogue and Magneto are a couple. They have a baby. And so it's kind of a trope, not a trope, but a theme that is used during the X-Men throughout their history. And so it makes sense that a younger, non-evil version of Magneto would become close friends with Rogue. And she'd want to, at the very least, keep an eye on him. And again, this makes Gambit so uncomfortable because he's very, I don't know, possessive of Rogue, but he's very protective at the very least of her. And he's got these conflicting feelings because he wants to, what he thinks is protect Rogue from Magneto, but he also knows that he sort of needs to protect Rogue from himself because he keeps alluding during this time to having some dark secret that is coming back to haunt him. But before we get to that, I want to keep talking a little bit about what's going on with Joseph in 1997. It's during this kind of era where he's like coming into his knowledge of his past self. He's coming into his powers. He doesn't have as much control as Magneto, who's been, you know, using his powers for forever, but he's younger, so he's not, you know, taken down by the vestiges of age as much. But he's joined the team. He's trying to reset everyone's notions of who he was, because he really thinks he was Magneto. If I haven't said it, I don't think I've said this point, what happens is that he's a clone. He is a young clone of Magneto that will come to terms with his creator soon. But that's the mystery. Sorry, spoiler, Joseph's a clone of Magneto. He's not the younger amnesiac version of Magneto. But in 1997, he becomes a very powerful ally for the team. He joins them in their space adventure when they get sent to space by Gladiator to help the Shi'ar with this whole Phalanx Covenant kind of problem. He saves their butt, like, plenty of times, because Magneto is very powerful. Magneto Prime is an Omega-level mutant. And so it's very helpful to have someone who has control over the electromagnetic spectrum while you're in space, it turns out. He also continues to grow closer and closer to Rogue, which is eventually aided by the fact that Gambit is kind of drawing away because of his secret. Rogue is very confused during this because she knows that she loves Gambit, but she also has feelings for this younger version of Magneto, and then Gambit's also given her mixed signals, so it's a very conflicting time for this girl while she's trying to, like, survive space, because a lot of stuff goes wrong with them in space. They eventually have to fight the Phalanx Covenant, which is always scary, because that's the alien techno-organic AI race that wants to just assimilate everybody, and so she almost gets eaten by the Phalanx Covenant, she's, like, trying to come to terms with her feelings that she's always had with Gambit, but then he's also like she absorbed Gambit's memories at one point, so she's getting some of these, it's cropping up these like shadows of this mystery that Gambit is hiding. So it's a very conflicting time for her. It's a very sad time for her. There's some very heartbreaking panels during this era of Gambit and Rogue having some sad moments together. I love it, but it also breaks my heart because I love Rogue. Rogue's my girl. I've always been just a huge fan of her. Let's finally get to what's going on with Gambit, because that's actually a major core plot point during Uncanny X-Men at this point. It takes over a lot of issues and plot points and finally leads to Gambit being put on this like mock trial near the end of 1997. In fact, I think it happens in the issue like that comes out in like November of 1997. So it's building up for the whole year. And no one knows at this point what it is. But here's what happened. During his younger years, when he was adopted into the Thieves Guild, Gambit was betrothed to the daughter of, or someone from, I think the Assassin's Guild is what they call themselves, but that's Belladonna. If you watch the cartoon, there's actually an episode in season two of X-Men cartoon that they cover this, where he's betrothed, but then that betrothal doesn't work out because Belladonna's brother Julian doesn't like that, so him and Gambit have a fight to the death. Gambit has to kill Julian, but because of that, that kind of puts a tarnish on his betrothal to Belladonna, and so he gets banished from the Thieves Guild and is excommunicated from New Orleans. He then takes up a lot of jobs wherever he can, and he's trying to figure out how to use his powers because they're a little bit out of control. And so he meets up with this guy named Nathaniel Essex, who is like one of the identities of Mr. Sinister. He gets in debt to Mr. Sinister because Mr. Sinister helps him control his powers. You can imagine if Gambit doesn't have control over his powers, that's a very difficult thing to deal with when he touches things and charges them up with all of their potential kinetic energy, which often leads to them exploding. So Mr. Sinister actually like takes a piece of Gambit's brain tissue out, which then like subdues his powers, and then he's in debt to Mr. Sinister because now he has control over himself. So what Mr. Sinister does have him do is a bunch of jobs where he's stealing stuff, but namely he does a bunch of things where he sends him off to recruit a bunch of seedy mutants and murderers, and this turns into becoming the team that's called the Marauders, which has always been Mr. Sinister's little lackeys and henchmen. And what they're known for is they're known for a big event called the Mutant Massacre, where Mr. Sinister unleashed the Marauders on the Morlocks, which are like the underground sewer dwelling ugly mutants, which are based off of like the Morlocks from the Time Machine novel. For those of you of literary nature, recall that. And so Gambit actually even led them to the Morlocks. He didn't know what he was leading them there for. Although I question, I'm like, what did you think that these murderous people were going to do with these mutants? I think story-wise, if I remember canonically, it's like Mr. Sinister led him to believe that he was going to recruit these, or he was going to save these Morlocks. But Sinister wanted to decimate them because he saw them as, you know, genetic dead ends, and he is all about euthygenics and about like solving for immortality and all that kind of stuff. And so, and he also loves playing and toying with mutants because he sees them more as tools instead of people. And so these are like bad tools, and so he's like, let's get rid of them. Gambit realizes this, tries to stop what's going on, almost gets murdered by Sabretooth in the massacre, but manages to save one Morlock, a little girl, who would later become the X-Men Marrow, who we'll talk about in a little bit because she's appearing in 1997. This all happens before he meets the youngified Storm in his first X-Men first appearance. And as far as like chronologically, this is when that happens, when he's younger. So this is well before he knows the X-Men, and he keeps this thing a secret for like forever. But then X-Men number 6, Sabretooth kind of blows his cover and kind of alludes to them having history together. And so that kind of brings up all these bad memories, and Gambit has dealing with all this guilt. And it eventually leads to him being brought in by someone called Eric the Red. Now, Eric the Red has been a character a couple times in the X-Men's history. Eric the Red was originally a Shi'ar agent. If you guys recall when we had the episode with Jacob Fullerton where we talked about the Starjammers, who are led by Corsair, Cyclops's father, Eric the Red was in those issues, and Eric the Red is like a kind of a nasty agent of the Shi'ar at that time because he's working mostly for not Lalandra, but Lalandra's brother, who was Deken, who was in charge and being kind of a dictatorial, you know, tyrant. And so that was one Eric the Red. And then there's another version of Eric the Red that was actually Cyclops in disguise, who was infiltrating Magneto's team at the time. This is like during like the 80s, I think, if I can place that on a timeline correctly. And so when Eric the Red shows up to the X-Men, they're like, that's why they point out in the comic, they're like, well, Eric the Red is often a cover. It's a fake person. But who is this that's Eric the Red that's putting Gambit on trial? It is Magneto, is who we find out at the end. That's the big reveal at the end, is that Magneto is alive, has been alive, and that also reveals that Joseph is not Magneto. And you might ask yourself a question, why is Magneto dressed up as Eric the Red putting Gambit on trial with all the X-Men present? And so what it is that Magneto has actually been alive and recovering in his Antarctic base for a little bit now, and he's been utilizing the fact that Joseph is with the X-Men to kind of use as a cover. Because if Joseph is with the X-Men and the X-Men think this could be Magneto, they're not going to go look for the real Magneto, and he can keep recuperating, making plans, and kind of, working on his plots in Antarctica. And so when they crash land in Antarctica and find their way to his Antarctic base, he's like, uh-oh, cover's blown. I should do some smoke and mirrors and get them all distracted by letting everyone know what Gambit did. And so Gambit, finally, all of his dirty laundry is revealed, And while the X-Men understand that he didn't know what he was doing, they can't fully, you know, forgive him. And so they basically say, like, we're not going to punish you, but we're also not taking you home. So you get to hang out here in the Arctic. And Gambit has to go through some adventures in the Arctic to survive and find his way back to the X-Men eventually. And he does obviously find his way back to the X-Men and finds himself back in good graces with them eventually. And even ultimately way down the line back in good graces with Rogue. And they eventually, you know, get married and all that kind of stuff. And it's these are very long timelines that there's a lot of time between these stories. So that's why it kind of makes a little bit more sense. But yes, that was the big reveal, was that Gambit was the reason, or one of the reasons, why the mutant massacre happened, which is at that point one of the greatest tragedies in mutant history. It would be overshadowed and pale in comparison to other things later, like House of M and Genosha and you know, all those kinds of moments. Right now it is, it's the big thing that everyone's like, oof, you helped with that? That sucks. It'd be like someone finding out that you helped with, like, you mistakenly helped, like, the assassination of Kennedy, something like that. That's what's going on with Gambit. You might read this and be like, who is this Trish Tilby lady? And I just wanted to give you a brief explanation of what's going on with Beast and Trish Tilby. This is during an era where Beast is still, like, a good guy, for the most part, and is the bouncing, joking, Beast that is happily dating Trish Tilby, who is an investigator, a journalist, who was originally investigating X-Factor, who Beast was a part of at the time, and when they were posing as mutant hunters. There was original X-Men, Cyclops, Jean Grey, Iceman, Angel, and Beast, and they were posing as alter egos for X-Factor, and they were like, we're hunting down mutants, but they were actually like saving mutants. And so she's investigating them. She had reported on their fight with Apocalypse, which is where we get Archangel from. That's during that era of X-Factor, and she eventually falls in love with the Beast. She actually appears in, like, when we were reading Inferno, she's there, and she's like trying to deal with the fact that Beast is kind of going through some stuff at that point. They broke up eventually when she was like, the X-Men have always kept like secret identities, and Professor Xavier has always kept his identity secret, and their base has always been a secret. You know, it's not at this, they don't let people know it's at the school in, you know, New York. But they eventually broke up when Trish Tilby reported on Moira getting the legacy virus, which Beast thought was a, you know, breach of confidentiality. But they always like were like an on again, off again kind of thing. So they got back together after Dark Beast, who is a stay over from the Age of Apocalypse, kidnapped real Earth 616 Beast. So this is them back together. That's where we're finding them in 1997. They will eventually break up again when Grant Morrison takes over the new X-Men, and this is after Beast goes through that secondary mutation where he now has a more cat-like animal look to him. And Trish kind of breaks up with him because it's at that point it's too far. He's kind of like, she doesn't say this, but it's kind of like he's de-evolving too far for her, and it feels too animalistic for her to continue this relationship. I call BS on that a little bit, but that's just me letting you know that's the history of what happened with Beast and Trish. But during the 1997 era, she is with him, and she's happy with him, and she's helping. She's helping them in space. She goes into space, and she's doing all that kind of stuff, and she's being like that human counterpart that's with the team sometimes. There's been a lot of people that are like that, like Valerie Cooper and Moira McTaggart before she got her retcon and all that kind of stuff, and so that's who Trish Tilby is. Other characters that you need to know about is that there's some stuff going on with Bishop and Deathbird. Deathbird is the sister of Lilandra. She's kind of the evil sister, but sometimes not evil sister. They find her on like this Shi'ar ship that was attacked by the Phalanx. I don't need to go into a ton of what was going on, but Bishop meets Deathbird while they're on this mission from Gladiator. He's the one who discovers her as the sole survivor on the ship, and he, you know, helps and nurses her back to health, and even helps her fight off the Phalanx from the Shi'ar hatchery where all their eggs are. During this fight, Beast basically Jeff Goldblum's from Independence Day, he does that thing to their phalanx, and which this is the version of the pure phalanx, and he infects them with basically a virus that destabilizes them and makes them retreat. The phalanx won't be seen again until like 2007, so like another 10 years until we see them during the annihilation event in Marvel Comics. But Deathbird does eventually sort of kidnap Bishop when they all get split up by going through a bad Stargate. And she leads him to believe that she's actually like nursing him back from the accident injuries, but she's actually like holding him like hostage just because she kind of has like the hots for him and thinks that he should be hers. She's kind of crazy like that. That's a lie that he's hurt. They later make up on that like front and actually are kind of a couple. They kind of get the hots for each other and then do a bunch of space adventures with each other because they're kind of stranded in space for a bit. There's a lot of people getting stranded and becoming couples in X-Men history. Now that I'm thinking about it, eventually Bishop makes his way back to Earth separate from Deathbird, and the comics don't really delve into that very much ever again. And there are three very new characters, though, that I do want to make sure you understand who they are, other than Joseph, that are going on in 1997. This is the era where we meet Marrow, Maggot, and Cecilia Reyes. They are kind of the three iconic new X-Men that were introduced in the late 90s. Some of them worked, some of them didn't work, but I always found them pretty interesting and fun, and I love new characters. I love attempts at new characters. It's just so fun to grow the X-Men roster because it's so big. Partly why I have this podcast, because everyone's like, I know Cyclops and Wolverine, but who's North Star? And I'm like, I'll tell you who North Star is, baby doll. But Marrow, as I mentioned, is one of the Morlocks. She was born to the Morlocks, and she's the one that survived the mutant massacre. Some of the Morlocks survive it and then are kind of put in this like pocket dimension by Colossus's brother, Mikhail Rasputin. Makes her way back, hates humans more than ever, starts a terrorist group to kill people, tries to go for Henry Peter Gyrick, who's like a U.S. agent who's racist and bigoted. After her mentor, Callisto, who's the kind of leader of the Morlocks, is injured, Callisto tells her to go join the X-Men and deal with her powers not working very well and hurting her, to deal with her anger issues. And so she goes with the X-Men and learns to use like these out of control bone growing and painful bone growing powers. She eventually does foster like almost like a father-daughter relationship with Gambit, which makes sense considering their history. And she is probably the more popular of these three characters that get introduced, but at some point writers don't know what to do with her and they kind of do her dirty, and she never becomes like a mainstay for the X-Men ever again at one point, which is very sad because I always liked Marrow as she evolved, as she figured out how to use her powers, as her look changed, everything. I liked her. There's be some more Marrow stories I want to read and talk to you guys about, but she's the one that was the most mainstay one at the time, but she didn't have longevity, and she hasn't had as much longevity as someone like Cecilia. But the one who kind of got the shortest end of the stick is Maggot. Maggot is introduced as a mysterious new mutant on the hunt for Joseph. We don't know why he's hunting for Joseph at the time, but we learn eventually that Magneto had been the one who had originally taught Maggot that he was a mutant, and he helped him with the discomfort of his powers. Maggot is this blue mutant that was having, like, when he was young, he was having all these abdominal issues and had to be on a specific diet. Turns out his abdomen is actually these two like slug-like creatures that he nicknamed Eenie and Meanie. They eat and then they go back to him, and that's how he gets his sustenance. But it's a very painful process at first, and Magneto helps him with that when he's young. But then when Magneto goes missing, Maggot goes and tries to look for him, and he uses, it's kind of like if you guys remember in Phantom Menace when the Jedis use their super speed one time and the Jedis have never used that super speed ever again. This is like that instance where Maggot this one time has these psychometric like memory powers that he can track down like the memories of a place, and he uses that to find Magneto, but he actually finds Joseph, and he finds Archangel and Psylocke instead. He eventually does attend the trial of Gambit and meets Joseph, and through that joins the X-Men, but like I said, never catches on as like a real popular character. His power is not very attractive and also not very applicable for a lot of combat situations, which is what the X-Men are put in a lot of times. He would eventually die at an internment camp in Weapon X, but he would come back in the Krakoan era. And he's made appearances in the Krakoan era, but he is sadly one of those characters that just like didn't work with the audience and just wasn't really used a ton. He's not like in the Grant Morrison era. He's not hardly at all during like the 2000s and isn't brought back, like I said, till Krakoa. The last one I want to go over is Cecilia Reyes, who I find to be very interesting and a very interesting take on a new person joining the X-Men. She first appears in X-Men 65, and she was always a reluctant joiner of the X-Men. She vehemently just wants to be a surgeon. She doesn't want to be a mutant. She just wants to be a normal person, and she just wants to do surgery. She doesn't want to go on space fights and get attacked by Sentinels, and she doesn't want to, you know, help, you know, them become their own nation, you know, in an island off of San Francisco. She eventually does join the Krakoan era later on and really is like a helpful part of like their, I guess their like healthcare plan. but at this time, she just wants to be a human. This is why she never has a code name. She's Cecilia Reyes. She also has poor control over her powers at this time, which are these force field powers. They kind of spark in and out. And in fact, when all of her like coworkers see like some mutants doing nasty things on the TV, she joins in with them and poses as a mutant hater, which some characters have done before, like Cannonball when he was younger, before he found out he was a mutant and joined the New Mutants. But yeah, she like tries to pose as one. But what happens is that a patient of her dies on the surgery table, but then turns out he's not dead. He's a prime sentinel, and then he goes hunting for her, which outs her as a mutant. So she has to leave the hospital at this point and go into hiding with the help of people like Iceman. Later on, she's like hanging out with the X-Men. She's like, I want to go back to being a surgeon. And so she tries to fit back into her job at Mother of Mercy, but like everyone there is being super bigoted. And they're like, there are staff members that are outing her to patients, and then there are patients who are like, I don't want a dirty mutant operating on me. Or, you know, she gets pulled off of a surgery last second because the family finds out she's a mutant. It's very much like, again, a continued parallel with the gay situation going on with like AIDS epidemic and all that kind of stuff. By the way, I think the gay situation would be a great band name. And speaking of the AIDS epidemic, what happens is that she's trying to make it through, you know, working at Mother of Mercy Hospital again, but it's not working out. But then this guy Pyro, who you guys probably recall from the X-Men cartoon, he shows up, and he is one of the people that during the Legacy virus era, he was like one of the poster children of like, he's got the Legacy virus, which makes sense because Pyro is very, very gay, that then they would apply this AIDS epidemic metaphor to Pyro. He's in the hospital after getting shot up, but then his powers are out of control, and they kind of like melted the slugs and like cauterized his wounds, so he's in pain. He's also not in control of his powers, because that's what the Legacy virus does. It loosens your control of the powers and also at the same time overpowers them. So if you're someone who like can control fire and that's out of control, it's really bad. And so Cecilia Reyes, who's able to use her force field a little bit at the time to be able to like operate on him, helps him. But then everything goes belly up when he tricks her into loosening his straps while he's in custody, because he's a criminal, and he escapes. And the hospital's like, that's the last straw. We didn't really want you here in the first place because you're a mutant and you're causing problems. But then you let a criminal out who's a mutant, you're fired. And this is how Cecilia finds her way, like permanently kind of bunking with the X-Men. She, like I said, never really wants to join them on like, you know, missions and stuff like that. But she's the reluctant person who, you know, has to shack up with them because she doesn't get to choose what her genetic inheritance is, which no one does. but that long explanation is what the Uncanny X-Men were doing in 1997. It's a lot, and I encourage you to go check out some of it. Like I said, it's beautiful, even if you don't want to read all the dialogue. I love Joe's art style. I love some of these characters. Joseph's very interesting take on Magneto. Rogue and Gambit's relationship troubles is so fun to catch up on and read up on. And I might be doing some more of the 1997 stuff, namely like I still want to do a Generation X episode, but I thought that was a fun way for you guys to know, like, when you jump into the new X-Men cartoon, which is coming out this month, that you get to go, oh, this is actually what was going on in the comics at the time. And now you get to be a little know-it-all if someone wants to ask you and be like, what's going on here? And I know the cartoon's going to go over a lot of stuff that isn't this, because there's characters like Emma Frost and Madeline Pryor and like Jean Grey being pregnant, or maybe Maddie being pregnant. We don't know yet because the show hasn't come out yet. And so that's not what's going on during this time. But you can be like, actually, during 1997, you can push your glasses up and go, the Beast was actually dating this woman named Trish Tilby. Anyways, I hope that's some fun little nuggets for you to use at your next cocktail party. Have a good time. I appreciate everyone who listens to the show, and especially our patrons at patreon.com/classofx. You guys are the best. Be good, be kind, be brave, and read some more comics, why don't you? Bye.